My name is Frank Weltner, and I am the librarian of GeeWatch, and I am here to welcome you to the world today. The world of jewelry. It is a thing of befuddlement and wonder. It is a study that never loses its interest. There is always something happening. There is always some deceit working down under the rock in the darkness. And we have to reach down under the rock and pull it up into the bright sunlight of public exposure in order to study it and to see what is really being done to us. For we are the victims of jewelry. We are the colony ruled over by the Jewish supremacists and those who have taken it upon themselves to create their hegemony over our world. The world in which we live is far larger than the world which is lived by the Jews themselves. For their world is lived at the pinnacle, on top of the mountain, on top of the pyramid. And they look down upon us as their children, as those whom they have befuddled, as those whose deceit has been ensured by their media, their banks, and their complete propaganda which they have constantly tossed into our midst. They are the queen bee and we are the drone. They are the ones who sup from the honey and we are the ones who produce it, who bring the pollen into the hive so that the queen bee may suckle from it and maybe some of it may fall from its lips onto the floor in front of our groveling feet. This is the way of the Jew and the Gentile. It is the way that it has always been, and the way that it probably always will be. There are very few certainties in this world, but one of them is that the Jew will be on top, and that the Gentile will be on the bottom. This is as clear as night versus day. And just as night versus day are part of the eternal rhythm of the universe, so is the rulership of the Jew over the Gentile. Will it never end? Some people take that defeatist attitude that it will never end, that it will always go on this way. But others see a light at the end of the tunnel, far distant from us, where people become aware of the fact that they are being used by the Jews, and that they have the power to change it. After all, the Jews are very, very few. They're a very tiny minority. And for them to rule, they must have your cooperation. If you were not to give them your cooperation, their pyramid would tumble, and they would be at a loss as to what to do. So in reality, each of us as Gentiles has the power to bring the Jew down, if we simply do not go along with the earthworks that he has placed between him and us. If we ignore them, if we go along our own trail and not follow the trail of the Jewish supremacists, if we do not take loans from them, thus feeding them illicit gains, if we do not pay taxes, if we do not work, if we go off by ourselves and ignore them, they would have to fend for themselves. And they would find that very, very difficult. Because they are spoiled and they are so used to working us and to having us cooperate with them, that they would probably die of fright. Then we have the problem of the Gentiles themselves, who are so used to working for the Jewish supremacists, of having their entire lives organized by paying their bank statements, paying their mortgages, balancing their books, and wondering why they can't get ahead. They would not believe it if you told them that you could actually purchase a house, for instance, without taking out a loan, that you could purchase a car without taking out a loan, and that before there were Jews, people used to buy and sell things without a bank run by a Jew issuing loans for people to buy their property. Yes, there was a time before the Jew when people used to sell land and buy anything they wanted on a handshake or upon a promissory note for which there was no interest whatsoever. There were ancient times in which these things occurred. There were more modern times in which these things occurred. The American Indian, for instance, didn't have any banks around. They would trade horses, they would trade rugs, they would trade their materials with each other, and there was no loan whatsoever. So it's pretty obvious that if someone that primitive can do this, people more sophisticated, such as ourselves in modern civilization, should be able to accomplish that also. The question is, are we willing to change the system? Are we willing to take the Jews off of our backs, the loans off of our backs, the taxes off of our backs, and go about our business the way men and women were meant to go about their business, free, able to work for themselves, and not to carry anyone else on their shoulders? I think that there is a time when we will be willing to do this, but I think the way that we're going to get there is through such websites as JewWatch.com, which will allow people to come and study the history of Judaism and of the banking system, of the corruption of societies all over the world, of the colonization of our societies by the New World Order, which is really the Jew World Order. We now have people who we call neocons in our White House. These are not really neocons, these are Judeocons, because almost every one of them is a Jew. And every one of them is the most dangerous person we have in our country today. These are the very people who counseled our president to start the war in Iraq, who counseled our president to claim that they were weapons of mass destruction, and who sent our sons and daughters into battle, where thousands of them have already been killed, and there is no end in sight. Why did they go? Because of the Judeocons, because of the Jewish world bankers, because of the arms merchants, those who have laid in wait, purchased arms companies, and need a war now and then in order to really rake in their profits. These are the Judeocons. These are the people who gather like eagles in our White House to seduce and destroy our president and to destroy our people. Why? For profit, pure and simple. What else do Jews want except money, profit, and greed? And they're able to get it because the Gentiles are willing to cooperate with them, to work with them, and to give them what they want. All it takes is the ability to say no, to have the courage to look at them straight in the eye and say, "We are not going to go down this road with you again. You have led us through World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. We are not going to walk with you again. We are closing our door to you, and we are walking away from you, and we are going to leave you on your own." You are listening to The World Today, and my name is Frank Weltner, and I am the librarian of Jew Watch, and I am glad that you have come to listen to the news of the Jews and of their organizations so that you can best prepare how to live your life and how to face the world today. It is a world in which you are surrounded by the Jewish elitists and the Jewish supremacists. It is a dangerous world, and it is the world that you must live in. And it is a world that can change, but you must see fit to change it. The Jews are always talking about tolerance and diversity. And this week when we had Martin Luther King Day, the Jews came forward and they performed before groups of people. A religious rocker and a civil rights organization have offered a free concert at University City High School to honor the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. University City High School is a high school that has long had a tradition of having an inordinate amount of Jews attending that school, because University City used to be almost a Jewish colony. So the tradition is there, but now there are some blacks living in University City. And for a while they ran that high school, but as the area continues to be regentrified, Jews are beginning to go back to University City High School. Many years ago, there were so many Jews that they probably were 95% of the student body. And I think that the Jews would kind of like to see that happen again. The concert was called Tear Down the Walls, and it was the brainchild of St. Louis and Rick Reck, a well-known Jewish musician who composes and performs rock music with Judaic messages. And you have to ask yourself, how could someone who does religious singing like that appear in a public high school, even during a holiday? Aren't churches supposed to stay away from high schools? Aren't synagogues supposed to? Doesn't this violate that separation of church and state that the ACLU, a Jewish organization, is always suing in court? Well, Rashtus, 35, performs about 150 concerts a year, and is a regular performer at the United Hebrew Congregation in Creefcourt. He is scheduled to perform in Memphis, Tennessee, in festivities concerning King's birthday, as well as at University City High School a few days later. What is Rex's point of view about the world? He says, on one hand, our society is much better about diversity than it was years ago. But then again, he said, the media still portrays stereotypes and contributes to prejudices. There are still hatreds that need to be dismantled. Well, Mr. Recht, I think you're totally wrong. First of all, our society is not much better about diversity than it was years ago, except that we've had a bunch of trainers come to our corporations and to our schools to browbeat people and to teach them things that they don't want to learn. For instance, if you go to Southwestern Bell Corporation to work, you have to go to diversity training. There's usually some rather large black lady who has a degree in urban studies or in sociology who comes in either working full-time for Southwestern Bell or as a consultant, and all of the people, black and white and yellow and whatever they are, have to sit there and listen to this. And if anybody objects, they get points against them, and they might even be removed from the company. There certainly won't be any discussion about whether or not diversity is good or bad. You either take it as it is, or you're fired. So, Mr. Recht, it's kind of a dictatorship for people of all races, because if they don't like diversity, they're going to have it stuffed down their throat. But you probably like that since you're Jewish, and you consider yourself a minority, and you want to be accepted, so you don't mind if you step on people in order to get that type of recognition, do you, Mr. Recht? You say that the media still portrays stereotypes and contributes to prejudices. I don't see that, Mr. Recht. When I look at football and basketball, all I see are African Americans, and all I see are people smiling and talking to them, and I don't care how low their intelligence might be, and there's some that have pretty low intelligence, and there are some that have high intelligence. But when we get to the really low intelligence blacks, they are interviewed as though they are perfectly normal human beings, when in fact anyone can tell that they're somewhat retarded. And if they interviewed a white person like that, they would probably say something about it. But being trained in diversity, which is a very rigid type of training that produces a reckoning of deceit that one must promulgate within one's own brain in order to keep up with it, they of course interview these people as though they are quite normal. And maybe for their group they are. But that would be a racist thing to say, so I don't really want to say it. And you say there are still hatreds that need to be dismantled. Yes, Mr. Recht, there are. Such as the hatred of your people in Tel Aviv against the Palestinians who live in that area. There's the hatred of your people in Israel who pass around little nasty cartoons of Arabs in very difficult positions, some of them sexual, with some really crazy statements like, these people breed like insects. Yes, Mr. Recht, there are still hatreds that need to be dismantled. But when they're Jewish hatreds against Goyim or against Gentiles, Mr. Recht, you don't seem to want to talk about it. And I wonder why that is. It probably has to do with the long history of Jewish supremacists figuring out how to fool people and how to operate behind a blanket of deceit. And the easiest way to hide is to point your fingers at someone else and to blame them for what you do in private. So, Mr. Recht, I hope that you and the black people and the Jewish people and the white people who come to you to see you perform at University City High School really enjoy themselves while they enjoy diversity. I think it's a wonderful idea. But we aren't quite finished, are we, Mr. Recht? You said in your story that the core value of Judaism is social justice, repairing the world. And you also said, I think that teens need some practical tools to use in creating a better world. And the program director for the League, Denise DeCue, said 30 students ranging in age from 13 to 18, oh, a very good age for propagandizing them, I would say, nice and young and impressionable, will take 16 hours of diversity training, beginning in February. She says this first session aims to train the students on how to handle diversity and bias issues in their community. Well, I'll bet, Ms. DeCue, that you will certainly advise them of exactly what to look for and exactly what to do, won't you? And you go on, Ms. DeCue, and you say, then in the fall we will show them how they can start diversity clubs at their own high schools or contribute new ideas to those that already exist. Well, isn't that wonderful? I assume that you're going to propagandize them as to how wonderful Jewish people are and black people, but you're not going to tell them too much about white people. That's what I would guess. That's what I've usually seen with these diversity programs and why I find them just a little bit two-faced and disgusting. You also said, Mr. Q, there is not a lot of awareness about Jews at your school. And sometimes that leads people to say some pretty insensitive things. Unfortunately, you hear a lot of anti-Semitic and anti-black stuff in school. Well, I'll bet in Tel Aviv that you find a lot of insensitive stuff about Arabs. And I bet you find that here in America too, don't you? And then you say, I'd like to learn how to handle situations better where someone makes those kind of remarks. I know some people who are now my friends before they knew I was Jewish would say things that bothered me. Once they found out I was Jewish, they stopped. It would be really cool to show others about how things they say carelessly can be hurtful. Well, Mr. Koo, I think that we could maybe take you and your Jewish people to some sensitivity training where we could show you that maybe banking, where you get money for a 0.5% or 1% and you charge other people anywhere from 5 to 25% for that same little piece of paper, maybe you could learn how that's insensitive and how it exploits people. I think that would be sensitivity training that you would probably enjoy, too. I think also that if you took the Jewish people that you know who refer to blacks as schwarzen in private and how they're kind of stupid, and you talk about that a lot of your people, I've heard you. Well, that might be sensitive, too, because it's not only what you say in front of people, but sometimes behind them. And, of course, it's hurtful if you think that they're kind of not as smart as you are to then go out and pretend that they are, even though in the back of your mind you're disrespecting them. Isn't that right, ma'am? Isn't that right, Mr. Koo? I think so. I think that you Jewish people really need some sensitivity training also about starting wars, and especially about starting European wars so that countries like Germany, France, United States, and England fight against each other, while your Jewish owners of the armaments factories make a heck of a lot of money and go home with the profits while everyone else has to spend the rest of their life either digging themselves out of debt by taking more loans from Jews who own banks, and in some cases they have to live their lives with their limbs missing. But Mr. Koo, I don't think you're going to talk about that. I don't think you Jews really want to have that type of diversity training, do you? No, I didn't think you did, and that's why I don't really take much that you people say about diversity very seriously. Because I know for a fact from your writings and from your Talmud and from the way that you act and start wars and charge people interest and try to get as many Jews as you can into Harvard and Yale, even though it's more than your numbers would justify, because you're prejudiced against Gentiles, that you really just don't want to hear that sort of sensitivity toward Gentiles. Because after all, Mr. Koo, your race is better than mine, isn't it? Yes, that's what I thought. The president of a European American rights group said Monday, he will continue a strategy to convince the University of Colorado to add people who represent his beliefs to a special Blue Ribbon Commission that is looking at diversity programs and issues at Colorado University. He said that CU President Hank Brown should select a person that probably we would like, we white people. Certainly not somebody that the Colorado University Diversity and Equity Office wants or puts on. The man who said this was Louis Calabro, president of the San Bruno, California-based European Issues Forum. And he was speaking to the Colorado Daily. Calabro made his demand Monday in a letter to the president of Colorado University. And then in an interview, Mr. Calabro blasted a symposium on white privilege held on the Colorado University Boulder campus last fall, and Mr. Calabro also slammed affirmative action. In Mr. Calabro's words, quote, "We need to be allowed to be heard when we want to talk about how we're victims of the political system and how we're ignored, how we're hurt," unquote. Calabro said he sent emails to the University of Colorado officials last week requesting information about who represents European Americans on the Blue Ribbon Commission, which is a 42-person panel named last week that will examine Colorado U's diversity programs. Several of the commission members are white, but Calabro wrote to CU last week that being a European American white person does not ensure in any way, shape, or fashion that that group's fair and enthusiastic representation will follow. The European American Issues Forum calls itself anti-hate, anti-racist on its website, though a prominent civil rights center isn't so sure that is an accurate description. The intelligence project at the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks hate groups, and the project's deputy director said she has heard of the European American Issues Forum before. What we're interested in, does it have an ideology of racial supremacy? We looked real hard at them last year, and we just didn't feel like we had enough information to make the hate group claim. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, who is the Southern Poverty Law Center to make any type of determination as to whether a white group or any group is a hate group? I mean, who graduated the Southern Poverty Law Center to be God? Who gave them this great power of judgment over others? Who caused them to arch themselves so high above the common run of people in this country that they could look down from their supremacist position, their supremacist position, to determine if a white person or group is a supremacist group? In order to do that, wouldn't you have to think that you yourself were a supremacist group? That you were supreme over them because you, after all, are the ones making the judgment? If you're making the judgment as to who's a hate group and who isn't, aren't you placing yourself in a supremacist position? And doesn't this put you on a hate group list yourself? If you're a supremacist group, you ought to alert all the citizens out there in America. It's just what you are, don't you think? William Ammons, who was 18 years old, was charged in the slaying of a 45-year-old Norris Gaynor who was bludgeoned with a baseball bat and died of head injuries. Police said that Ammons shot the victim with a paintball gun. The young man had initially been accused only of assaulting another homeless man. He was released from jail on $5,000 bail on the assault charge, but was arrested again a few hours later on the murder charge. These murder charges had been brought against a third teenager Tuesday in a string of beatings of homeless men last week in Florida. Now, Ammons, Bran Hooks, and 17-year-old Thomas Daugherty were all arrested in connection with three beatings of homeless men. Hooks and Daugherty also faced murder charges in Gaynor's slaying. Hooks and Daugherty were identified and arrested after one of the beatings was captured on a security video at Florida Atlantic University. At least that was according to police. And I'm looking at a picture of Brian Hooks, who's 18 years old. He appeared in a video image in a court in Fort Lauderdale. And he is surrounded by people who do not look like him. Looks to me like he's surrounded by blacks and by Jews who came to admire the show, to see exactly what would happen to this young white person who's been accused of murder. So here he is in a hostile environment, And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with black people or with Jewish people coming to watch this person who is unfortunately alleged to have been involved in a murder. But it seems to me that when the courtroom is filled with blacks and with Jewish people, that you really have a racist situation going on here. You have people who have a certain hatred against white people in general because they have enough desire to come and see this person. It reminds me of these movies years ago where white people would come to town because a black man had raped or murdered a white woman. And in these films, the white people show up just to gawk and look at the person so they can look down on him. And the Jewish supremacists used to churn out films like that about these lynchings. Like, I just find it rather disgusting that here we have these Jewish and black people coming here to look at this young white man. You'd think they would just leave him alone. He's got enough problems. But no, they came to gawk. Now, can you imagine a movie about these Jewish people and black people? You know, kind of dust them up so they look really seedy. Put them in torn clothes so they look like trailer trash. And here they come in to gawk at an innocent white man. And they want to lynch him. Now, can you imagine a movie showing Jewish people who are half drunk saying, I think that we ought to lynch that white SOB. And the blacks come up and say, yeah, I think we ought to lynch him too. And they all get around and they lynch him. Can you imagine a movie that would do that? Of course you can't. And the reason you can't is that you don't own the movies. The Jewish supremacists own the movie theaters. They own the movie studios. And they are the actors, and they're not going to produce a film like that. Oh, if it makes white people look bad, they would. But if you were to make the Jewish people and the black people look just as bad as they make you look as a white person in their racism toward you, you're not going to see that. That's just not the way it is, and that's why they own these particular properties, these movie studios, is so that they can make you look bad and make themselves look good. And in their racism, it makes them feel good to do that. And since you don't have the gumption to buy these things, you're just going to have to put up with it. The corruption of the super Zionist Jack Abramoff continues to be a story that has a lot of traction in the press. And the New York Times and ABC News just could not understand why a super Zionist like Jack Abramoff, who's a master of public relations, would just walk out of a courtroom where he pleaded guilty to 3 felony counts wearing a mafioso-style black fedora. They could not understand the bizarre spectacle, but Jews did. They recognized Abramoff's headgear all too well as a sign of Jewish orthodoxy and piety. And it's far from ironic that Jack Abramoff would wear such a hat into a courtroom. It seems that from start to finish, his career in lobbying and his cover-ups have been cloaked in religious garb. For instance, the first example, and maybe the best of Abramoff's religious antics, comes from a story that was reported in 2005 in the New York Times Magazine. He had been nominated for membership in the Cosmos Club, which is an exclusive Washington insiders organization. And Abramoff was flattered by the nomination, but he knew all too well just how newly cool he was in Washington circles. And Abramoff feared that the club would realize that the emperor had no clothes. Abramoff knew that he needed some serious moral and intellectual credibility, and he needed it right away, so he reportedly called his rabbi and longtime supporter, Daniel Lappin, who was the head of the right-wing organization called Toward Tradition. And he asked Rabbi Lappin if he could patch together some award in his honor, something like Scholar of Talmudic Studies. Abramoff wrote that in an email to Lappin. While Lappin was at it, Abramoff asked him if he could make it appear that he had received these in years past, and Rabbi Lappin assured him that it was no problem. So he did. Evidently, the story only touches the surface of the disturbing relationships between Abramoff and his rabbis. For instance, Abramoff founded the Eshkol Academy. What is the Eshkol Academy? It is an Orthodox Jewish school in Maryland. And here comes David Lappin, who is the rabbi's brother, who served as the dean. And according to emails, it was revealed that during the U.S. Senate hearings into the Abramoff-Ralph Reed Indian gambling scandal, that Lappin was reportedly paid $20,000 a month through Abramoff's Capital Athletic Foundation. The Eshkol Academy closed in 2004 after the press raised some questions about it, and it was later discovered that 13 former Eshkol employees sued the Academy for back salary, claiming that the Capital Athletic Foundation was used to launder funds from the tribes to Eshkol. And federal tax records show that various Indian tribes donated more than $1 million to the foundation. So here you have this super Zionist, Jack Abramoff, playing around with everybody's money and wearing a Jewish hat so that his piety would be known to all Jewish people in the country. And you have to ask yourself, why would he do this? Why would it be so important to him, with all of his federal problems, to be wearing a Jewish hat as a sign to Jews all over the country that he was one of them? And I think that the answer comes in the power that the Jewish elites have. He wasn't sending the message to the little Jewish guy who works 9 to 5, some of whom work in factories even as common factory workers. No, he was sending the message to the Jewish bankers, to the Jewish lawyers, to the Jewish judges, to the Jews in the Senate and those who worship the Jews in the Senate, those who will pass anything that Israel wants. He was appealing to these people because he knows that the way for him to get out of this is to enlist the rich and valuable, those who have access to the government, those who can buy him a pardon, who could put pressure on the FBI and other groups to maybe lay off of Mr. Abramoff, or maybe arrange the case so that he might be able to bring his plea bargain down to something where he won't even go to jail. These are things that could be done in Washington. You'd be surprised what friends with money can do for you in the United States of America, where everybody's on the take, where everybody is easily corruptible, where instead of pride, instead of self-worth, the worth of a person is determined by the amount of money that he can put into his bank account. And if that money has to do with Jack Abramoff, with Israel, with selling out the United States of America and supporting another country and its foreign policy and its will, well, if you make money at it, it's really not that bad. After all, it's been going on for years, hasn't it? The Jewish supremacists get what they want, and Jack Abramoff is wearing a rabbi's hat just to appeal to these people, because he knows, hey, they can help me. And who would know better than Jack Abramoff? The corruption of our politicians extends to little cities like St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up, and the mayor of St. Louis, Francis Slay, is being escorted to Israel by his Jewish masters, the people who pay for his campaigns and who he enlists, evidently, to man the phone lines, etc., when he's running for mayor. In any case, he doesn't want them to do anything that might hinder his election possibilities. And so it wasn't really surprising to me that there was a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch this week showing how Mayor Francis Lay is on a junket to Israel, being led by the nose by his Jewish cohorts, and the Lubin Green Foundation, which is a family philanthropy that supports Jewish causes in St. Louis, has paid for Slay and his wife Kim to go on the trip. It's part of a, quote, outreach mission organized by the St. Louis Jewish Federation. And going along with Slay, we have Washington University's Chancellor Mark S. Wrighton and Jewish Federation Executive Vice President Barry Rosenberg. It's just a nice little cuddly crew, you see. Now, you have to ask yourself, why would these Jews be spending all this money? to take the mayor of St. Louis to Israel. Well, when you see this outreach mission, outreach, what are they reaching out for? They're reaching out for friends of Israel. That's what they're reaching out for. And this particular trip is part of a two-week trip for Mayor Slay of St. Louis. Because after he returns from Israel in a week, he'll then jet to the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in Washington. And the Israel trip isn't the first time that Francis Slay has enjoyed a free trip abroad in the past year and a half. He went to China and visited an Anheuser-Busch brewery in Wuhan. But getting back to this Israel visit, when he's in Israel, I'll tell you what's going to happen. He's going to be wined and dined by propaganda ministers of the Mossad and the Shin Bet. He's going to endure lectures about terrorism and about right-wing causes in the United States of America. He might even hear about Jew Watch that's in his own city, and could you do something about that, perhaps, to show us that you like us? We who are Jews, we who are in Israel, because that guy Frank Weltner's kind of getting under our skin over there. He's even putting radio on the internet now. And whatever you can do to hassle him, we would certainly appreciate it. Well, you know how these little friends get together and they kind of conspire to do things? I think that's what we have going on here. They may not be talking about Jew Watch, but they're certainly going to be talking about the problems of terrorism and how it relates to right-wing Christians, how it relates to neo-Nazis, and whatever other nasty name they want to call people whom they don't like. It's a part of the Jewish ad hominem attack. If you can't attack the message, you attack the messenger. And Jews almost never respond to a message. They only attack the people that speak the message. Now, the nice thing about paying for a mayor's trip to Israel is that you have total control over him. You're the one who was able to make the itinerary. Of course, I'm sure that since he's Catholic, that they will make sure that Mr. Slay gets to visit some Catholic areas, like maybe some monuments. Perhaps a little trip to Bethlehem, maybe one up to Galilee. Places where Jesus walked, they'll let him see that, and they'll let him know while they're showing it to him that Israel is protecting these places for the Christians, and that Israel is the friend of the Christians. Even though Israel and its agent, the ADL, is attacking the evangelicals in the United States, but that will not be mentioned. No, that will not be mentioned at all. They will, of course, bring up the Holocaust and how the right-wing neo-Nazis of America, whoever they might be, and they might be whoever the Jews want to say are the neo-Nazis. They don't have to really have a swastika. They don't have to have anything. They just have to have the attention of the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center, who both of whom have set themselves up as supremacists over the American people. And by supremacists, I mean that they have decided that they are supreme over all of us, and they are the ones who therefore get to call people haters. When in fact, by their very activities of watching over all of us, they themselves are showing themselves to be the masters of hate and innuendo and deceit. But they have huge budgets, well over $100 million for both of them each year. And with a budget like that, they can do quite a lot of damage. And they do. Take a look at this trip. That costs a lot of money. Of course, they're not really paying for it. There's a foundation or a family in St. Louis that's paying for it. But it's all a part of the same operation to soften up the Christians of America, to let each individual group or politician, such as Slay, and I'm sure that the mayor of New York gets his chance to go to Israel for his propagandizing. And of course, then you have Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who right now is being spanked, but I think they're going to stop spanking him pretty rapidly because his projects in Israel will mean a lot of money to the Israeli government in their process of genocide against the Palestinians who live within the area. And they'll want to have that money so they can continue killing Palestinians with abandon as they have so enjoyed doing over the years. And they're certainly not going to stop. So at any rate, Mayor Francis Slay of St. Louis right now is sitting down somewhere around Tel Aviv,
listening to a lecture by some Jewish fanatic as to what's wrong with America, how American freedoms have led to such atrocities as Jew Watch, which has the audacity to study what the Jews are doing, including Mayor Slave's very visit to the terror state of Israel. The corruption of our politicians by the Jewish elitists never ends. For instance, Tom DeLay, who's on the outs now because of his legal problems, Tom DeLay's Jewish friends and enemies, they can expect the same friendliness to Israel and affection for faith-based funding from whoever replaces him as majority leader in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's under indictment for alleged campaign finance abuses in Texas. And he's reportedly being investigated in Washington for his ties to the disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And DeLay has resigned from the second-ranking House job this weekend. So the question that the Jews are asking is, can we trust his replacement to be just as forthcoming as Mr. DeLay was? And I think the answer is yes, because the two declared candidates to succeed Tom DeLay are Roy Blunt of Missouri, who's the Republican whip, and John Boehner of Ohio, the chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee. Both of them are 56 years old, and both of them are very, very friendly to Israel. Would you expect anything less? I mean, how else would they be able to maintain their position in the House, their position as a congressman, without kissing up to the Israeli menace? The vote as to who will replace DeLay will take place after President Bush's State of the Union address on January the 31st. Tom DeLay, incidentally, was known for his true affection for Israel and its settlement movement. You know, the movement where the Israelis took over more and more Palestinian land, put armed Israeli thugs in fortresses, and terrorize the Palestinians around them. That settlement movement. Tom DeLay was known for his love for Israel's settlement movement. And Boehner and Blunt don't have the same closeness to Israel's right wing, but heck, both men have records that please the pro-Israel community. For instance, just like Mayor Francis Lay of St. Louis this week, guess what? Both have traveled to Israel. That means both of them have been successfully propagandized as to the needs of Israel. They've been wined and dined and corrupted, and their voting records reflect this. They're very strong. And an official of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee said that both of them are great candidates. The official spokesman, by the way, didn't identify himself because it's IPAC's policy not to comment on political races, which is kind of ridiculous since they fund them. Blunt probably has the advantage when it comes to Israeli issues. He works with Representative Steny Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland, who is his Democratic counterpart, and Blunt has initiated a bunch of pro-Israeli resolutions that are guaranteed overwhelming passage in our Zionist-occupied legislature. And he leads a trip to Israel every 2 years for Republican freshmen. The Jewish supremacists definitely have Roy Blunt in their pocket. He has been eager and willing to be a role model and a passionate advocate with regard to other members on the Middle East as a senior community leader with strong Republican ties. Blunt has taken the opportunity and run with it to do a number of proactive things with the Jewish community. Well, isn't that wonderful? If Blunt is distinct from DeLay in any way, it's that he has shunned American Jews and Christian evangelicals who speak for Israel's far right, a constituency that considers DeLay a hero. But Blunt has tended to turn away from them. To show how he could kiss up under the Jews so successfully, Mr. Blunt helped pass a House resolution last year welcoming the election of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, fending off attempts from DeLay's office to water it down. As Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon formulated his plan to withdraw from the Gaza Strip, Blunt did not return calls from hardline settlers who visited Washington to lobby against the pullout. In 2003, Blunt married a lobbyist for the tobacco industry, Abigail Perlman, who is Jewish, in a Jewish ceremony with a rabbi. Blunt already had warm Jewish ties stemming from his relationship with St. Louis communities, but Jewish lobbyists say that Perlman deepened those relations. Yes, it's all in the family, just like any other little mafia thing. You marry a Jewess, you can be the Speaker of the House. William Daroff, the top lobbyist in Washington for the United Jewish Communities Federation umbrella group, who until recently was a deputy director of the Republican Jewish Coalition, said that Ms. Perlman, who is now Mrs. Blunt, has been a key liaison with the Jewish world and has helped to expand her husband's knowledge and relationship with the community, unquote. A key focus for Mr. Blunt has been trying to end traditional Jewish financial and electoral support for Democrats. Blunt told the JTA in a November 2004 Election Eve interview, quote, "Increasingly, if you ask a Jewish voter which party is more dependably pro-Israel and focused on the war on terrorism, they would say the Republican Party," unquote. Isn't that interesting? A person's worth to the Jews is more important than his worth to the Gentiles. And that's what's so sick about this country, is there's always some Gentile who is ready to go so far as to marry a Jewess in order to glean the loyalty of the Jewish community. This is similar to what you saw in the Soviet Union, where Stalin married three Jewesses so that all of his children were Jewish. Where Trotsky was Jewish, where Lenin married a Jewish woman, and he was Yiddish himself. And of course, Stalin, although he was raised by Catholics, he was of Jewish heritage because his name, Dishvegli, which he changed to Stalin, which means steel, just like most Jews, always wanted to change his name. And why did he want to change his name? Because Stalin's original name, Dishvegli, meant little son of a Jew, little Jewison. Well, that wouldn't be too nice for a dictator who wanted to appeal to the Russians of all types, some of whom might even be anti-Semitic since the Jews were coming in and killing a lot of their family members night after night. Perlman, you've heard of Perlman, that great super Zionist, has figured in a controversy that could dog candidates eager to distance themselves from lobbying scandals of the sort that brought down DeLay. And Blunt revealed that he has a relationship with Perlman going back to 2003, only after he had championed legislation that would have favored the tobacco industry. And just think, he got a bride out of that. Both men, however, are controversial for the majority of the Jewish community, because both of them oppose the erosion of laws keeping government funding from going to groups that discriminate on hiring based on religion. And of course, the Jews don't want that because they're only 2% of the country, and they would rather discriminate against the other 98% who are Christian and who love to hire their own. Of course, the Jews hire their own. I mean, take a look at Hollywood. How many Gentile actors and actresses do you see by comparison to the Jewish actors and actresses? I don't think anyone has claimed that Jane Fonda is Gentile. I don't think anyone's claimed that Ben Affleck is Gentile. There are a few Gentiles, but the Jews definitely hire their own. But when it comes to Christians hiring their own, they have a real problem with that. And these two congressmen who are running for DeLay's job evidently think it's quite all right to hire on religious reasons. Because, let's face it, if it's a Lutheran church that's handing out welfare to a Katrina victim, obviously they would most likely hire Lutherans. Of course, if the Jews were being realistic and truthful, they would hire Lutherans to read their Torah for them instead of hiring a Jew to be a rabbi. There's no reason why, after all, a good Gentile like a Lutheran minister couldn't be a successful rabbi in a Jewish synagogue. But somehow the Jews just don't hire them. They tend to hire their rabbis religiously, don't they? But if the federal government funds somebody who is hired because they're a Christian, well, that's wrong, isn't it? I think we're looking at the Jewish double standard here, and the Jewish neuroticism, and their hatred for Gentiles, and the fact that these two Gentiles are panderers to this conspiracy against Gentiles in our country, known as the Jewish community, I think it's something that we really need to pay attention to. We need to focus on it. We need to investigate it, because it's pretty obvious that they have worked very long and hard to corrupt these two individuals, enough so that Mr. Blunt married a Jewess. Now that's really getting down to the nitty-gritty of control. And I'm sure that Mr. Blunt measures up a lot better than Boner does. Boner, you need to marry a Jewess. You don't have a chance at getting this job. It's going to be Blunt all the way. Anybody who marries a Jewess to get a job, that's the man who's going to be hired. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Those of you who are the 98% of the people in this country who are Gentiles, the man who is going to replace Tom DeLay is married to a Jewess and is therefore a part of the Jewish family. And guess what? You are not a part of the Jewish family. Do you think you're going to be represented? Or do you think Israel and the ADL and the ACLU is going to be represented? It's time for you to wake up and take your country back. The Iranian president, in a speech in Tehran, called for Israel to be wiped off the face of the earth. And this got a healthy amount of coverage by the international media. It was covered also by Jew Watch, which is a part of the international media. Yet despite the number of stories published and broadcast, one of the key elements that address the World Without Zionism conference was overlooked, ignored, spiked, if you will, by major press organizations. It wasn't just a world without Zionism in Israel that the Iranian president and his friends in Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and other terrorist groups were envisioning. It was a world without the United States of America. It was a world without England. It was a world without Russia. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, and in this case it is literally true. The Iranian president gesticulated as he was saying this at a podium, which showed the name of the conference, but in the wider view there was a complete poster for the event, which showed two spheres, one of them with the Star of David and one with the American flag. Both spheres, including a sphere of the earth, were inside of an hourglass. One of them represented the United States cracked at the bottom of the hourglass, with another representing Israel falling toward the same future. It wasn't just the imagery of the conference that was overlooked by the press, ignored and unreported. It was also the anti-American substance of the speech. What was the reason for this? The reason for this being overlooked was the Zionist press. The Zionist press feared that telling you that when your country, the United States, is associated with Israel, that you and Israel both are doomed in the eyes of the Arabs, that the Muslims wish to destroy both of you, which would mean, of course, that if you don't support Israel, if you stay clear of Israel, you would not be threatened. And they didn't want you to know that. That's the trouble with having a Zionist press that represents Israel but does not represent the United States that it preaches to. It is a great danger to our nation that the Zionists continue to own 95% of our presses and use them to thoroughly indoctrinate, blind, and oppress us. The Arab nations are in a quandary concerning nuclear power. On the one hand, they were assured that when Israel got nuclear power that they would be totally safe. And yet they've noted the increased belligerence of Israel for the last 20 years, ever since it was announced that they had nuclear power. So now when Iran begins to flex its nuclear muscle and to possibly work toward a nuclear weapon, the other nations of the Middle East are just as frightened, because they don't know whether to trust Pakistan, India, and Iran with their weapons, or to trust Israel. After all, the nations that do not have nuclear weapons are at an extreme disadvantage. They are threatened constantly by the possibility that these weapons may either be used against them or rattled in their face like a saber, forcing them to do things that they do not wish to do. There is no nuclear umbrella protecting Saudi Arabia or Syria or any other nation in the Middle East. Only Israel receives the nuclear umbrella from the United States of America. If you lived in the Middle East and Iran were developing a nuclear weapon, you might on the one hand think, well, perhaps this will protect us from Israel, but on the other hand, you might think, if an aggressive dictator like Saddam Hussein takes over Iran, then my country may be invaded and there will be nothing we can do since we do not have a nuclear weapon. So we must keep in mind that there is a two-edged sword with nuclear weapons in the Middle East. And it is a two-edged sword that cuts both at Israel and at Saudi Arabia, and it cuts at all of the other nations in the Middle East. Every year at the General Conference of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Arab representatives request that the agency condemn Israel's nuclear arsenal and demand that Israel join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Arms Control Pact. They demand that Israel open all its nuclear facilities to inspection and call for making the Middle East a region free of nuclear weapons. This drive, however, is continually stymied by the United States and by European Union opposition. Meanwhile, Israel remains noncommittal, neither admitting nor denying possessing nuclear weapons. As the war of words between Iran and Israel heats up, Arabs feel caught in the middle. Last December, leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is made up of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and Oman, met in Abu Dhabi to discuss the current hotspots of the Middle East, the war in Iraq, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Syrian-Lebanese crisis, and Iran's controversial nuclear program. One conference official said that there is concern that Iran's nuclear program could be weaponized. And at the end of the day, the Iranians are building a nuclear reactor across the Gulf. There is also concern that if there is any military action against Iran, Iran might retaliate and attack pro-U.S. allies in the Gulf. These nuclear programs of both Iran and Israel go back decades. The Iranian nuclear program began in the Shah's era in the 1960s, under the auspices of the United States. Iran's first nuclear research center was equipped with a U.S.-supplied 5-megawatt nuclear research reactor. The Shah at the time had plans to build as many as 23 nuclear power stations across the country, with help from the United States. Meanwhile, Israel's nuclear ambition practically began at the creation of the state. In 1949, for instance, Hemed Gimel, a special unit of the Israeli Defense Forces Science Corps, began a geological survey in the Negev Desert in search of uranium reserves. Later in 1952, the Israel Atomic Energy Commission was created. At that time, its chairman, Ernst David Bergman, declared that an Israeli bomb was the best way to ensure that we shall never again be led as lambs to the slaughter. So as you can see, the nuclear weapons program of Israel and the nuclear program of Iran have been going on for decades. But at this moment, the nations of Europe and the United States and Israel are extremely concerned about what Iran is doing. But they don't seem too concerned about Israel. The question remains, does Israel have the 200 nukes that people say they have? Or is that nothing but a deceitful ploy? Does Iran really want nuclear weapons? Or is that simply propaganda from people who would like to start a world war? We'll just have to stay tuned to see how this plays out. You have been listening to a presentation of The World Today, My name is Frank Weltner. I am the librarian for Jew Watch at www.jewwatch.com. Thank you for listening, and have a very nice day.